She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. You are indeed listening to Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And in case you missed it in the intro, we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, and we cannot emphasize that enough. So let's be thinking today. Our guests are going to be incredible. They come with an unbelievable depth of knowledge about an issue very near and dear to my heart. And if you follow me on Facebook and Twitter or have read some of my blogs, it's about not just the Gulf oil spill and like where did that was a year ago almost. It'll be a year in April, I believe. And what happened? How can people not be remembering it? And also kind of integrated with that is the discussion about clean water. And they're part of the Gulf Monitoring Consortium. And their names are John Amos, who is the president of Sky Truth, and Jim Grody, who's the conservation director of South Wings. And their other partner, who could not be on the show today, is the Water Alliance. And they launched a consortium. So first of all, I'd like to say welcome to John and Jim. Are you there?
We're here. Thank you, Mr.
It
Green.
Worked.
Thank you.
It worked. We're trying some new technology, and I'm very open and honest with my listeners. And this show is, to me, so important and will so be promoted to all of our listeners about the content. Thank you both for taking the time to be on the show and also for what you do. And I am a self-professed whirling dervish, and I try to remain linear in my questions, but I'm not promising anything. So why don't we start? And there's no, you know, it's not he said, she said, or you go first or whatever, but one of you or both of you give your insight. I like to start with a little bit of history. How did the Gulf Monitoring Consortium come to be? You both have long histories in the world of studying oil disasters, it looks like, or maybe in your own area. So just go a little bit on that and what role your companies each have or your organizations in the Gulf Monitoring Consortium.
Well, I guess I'll take a first crack at that. The idea actually came about when at SkyTruth we were actually approached by South Wings, and this was during the heat of battle during the Gulf oil spill last year, when there was a real striking lack of good information about what was happening, and that caused a lot of people in the Gulf region to be very suspicious that they weren't hearing all of the things that they needed to be hearing, that they weren't being told the full truth, and that suspicion lingers to this day. And at SkyTruth, we were getting inundated with requests for satellite imagery to investigate oil slicks and see if there were other leaks and spills going on out there that were being covered up somehow by the government or by industry. And South Wings came to us, and they were having pretty much the same experience. And, you know, it's a lot of work to get somebody up in an airplane and fly out far offshore, and it can be a little bit dangerous. And they, understandably, wanted to be very careful about how they use their resources to do that kind of work. And at SkyTruth, getting and processing and analyzing satellite images also is a good bit of work. So we wanted to be careful about that. And we decided it would be smart for us to team up and work together to help each other out. SkyTruth looking at things from space, South Wings looking at things up a lot closer from the air. And then we thought, hey, wouldn't it be great if we even had a partner who could get out on the water and investigate things, you know, from the fish's eye view, so to speak.
And John,
the idea for the consortium was born.
Okay, so when you say that you know you were inundated with requests, it's kind of heartening to me. What were the typical kinds of organizations or individuals that were appealing to all of you for better and more accurate information? I mean, the public, obviously, by and large, was not, or maybe that's not true. So when you say that you got inundated, both of you and you know, the third organization, Waterkeeper, who was asking for this kind of information?
From our perspective, it was everybody. It was community organizations.
Right.
It was conservation organizations.
Okay.
It was the general public.
So people really did care and say what's really happening. Tell us the truth.
That's right. And I think we established some credibility early on when we were able to point to, and I think SkyTruth did this as well, we were able to point to some things that were coming out of the government and industry mouths that were demonstrably false. And so we were able to show why that was untrue. So we gained some immediate credibility with a lot of people that way. And they continued to look to both of us as credible and necessary organizations.
You know, it's funny. I've had some people on the show that were there, or people related to that I think are still working, like from the Nature Conservancy. The person that I had on my show was not there after the disaster, but someone that I had actually from the Humane Society. She was a national player at the Humane Society. You know, bringing in that whole piece that you don't think about of the ongoing implications for the wildlife and the animals, and that's a long-term commitment when you're doing that. But when you go to the truth, I mean, when I was my life was so literally consumed by this and knowing what was going to happen, how much was it minimized? How much worse was it than we got in the, you know, the Associated Press, for example? Was it a lot worse than we ever got to find out? I mean, if you look on Google, I can find out a lot more information. But in terms of the general public and the availability of accurate information, what did you guys find? John or Jim, either one of you, just take it.
Well, I'll talk about what we saw in satellite imagery. And this was in the early days of the spill. I worked for 10 years as an exploration geologist, so I had good familiarity with the offshore oil production operation out in the Gulf of Mexico. And when I heard that there had been an explosion on board a deep water drill rig, I immediately thought, uh-oh. Hopefully nobody was hurt or killed, but that's an extremely hazardous situation. Hopefully all of the systems work properly and shut that thing down, because deep water wells are high production wells, so there's the potential for a big spill. And we started looking at satellite imagery as soon as we could get it. And the images showed an oil slick that was large when we first got a look at it, and rapidly grew in size after that. And we were able to calculate within the first week of the spill that the actual rate that oil was flowing out of that well on the seafloor had to be at least 20 times greater than what we were being told by the federal government and by BP. They were saying 1,000 barrels a day, and we were seeing what had to be closer to actually 25,000 barrels a day. And it turns out now that, you know, once we made those statements, eventually the federal government assembled a team of scientists using several different techniques to try to accurately estimate the rate. And the final number that they came up with after a couple months of study was actually 60,000 barrels a day.
So you are kidding me.
More than twice as great as what we were seeing. And so I think that experience really demonstrated the value of having a scientifically credible tool at your disposal, like satellite imagery, and also having independent entities like SkyTruth with expertise to be able to, to weigh in on issues like this. And then having the ability to actually fly over these areas and get firsthand observations like you can do with Southwings, it really makes a much stronger investigative package for our consortium.
And Jim, one of the things that I read about in doing my research for Southwings is there really is a global significance to the ecosystems of every area. But the Southwest, of course, is no exception. So what part can you bring to the listeners that I have for an understanding of the environmental impact? We're one planet, so there are challenges environmentally. It's not like, oh, well, it happened over there. It's we're one planet. That sounds really kind of a firm grasp on the obvious, but some people have that disconnected, oh, well, that's over there. And when it comes to me to preservation of the planet, there is no over there. It's like, here we are. It's just one planet. And what is your, in terms of the vision of Southwings, to bring to the public and providing an understanding of that, you know, the environmental challenges that if it's happening in the Southwest region, we all should be paying attention as well.
Right. Well, I think one of the most striking examples of that in the Gulf is that something like 65% of the seafood that we eat throughout the entire country comes from the area right around here where the BP oil spill happened, the Gulf Coast of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. If you eat shrimp, if you eat oysters, if you eat many of our fish,
60%.
It's something like that.
Yeah,
I don't recall the precise number, but
huge.
it's an astounding percentage of the seafood that we eat. If you eat any of these things, you're almost certainly eating it from the Gulf. And so what happens in the Gulf really does affect you, even if you live in Tucson or Seattle or Maine. Maine has its own seafood industry that is a great industry, but they're not getting any shrimp from Maine. They're getting their shrimp in Maine. They're getting their shrimp from the Gulf.
And right, so right.
It really does affect all of us in many ways. And at the same time, we're all the cause of it. You know, we all drive cars. We all, or even if we take public transportation, we're using oil from the Gulf. And so it goes both ways.
And there's a part of it. I mean, one of my sponsors for the show is Chapman. It's a big car dealership here in Tucson. They've got like 7 car dealerships. And one of the reasons I approach them about sponsorship is because they have some of the most fuel efficient cars on the planet. And every day that I get in my car that gets 44 miles a gallon and it's clean diesel, you know, clean fuel burning, I feel noble about it. It's one of the cars that they, you know, highlight. It's a VW. And I think it's about connecting the dots. Now, I want to go a little bit to water keepers, too, since they're not here. They're on the front line on the water. And so you've got, like, space, as John said, and you've got the sky with the airplane, the planes, and then you've got on the water. What role did they play? And did they approach you, or was that something, Jim, that you said, okay, John, let's do this, let's get in water keepers as well?
Well, I'm going to have to actually defer that over to John because I was not personally with Southwings when that happened, and so I don't know exactly how it happened. I apologize.
That's okay.
Well, we can, it was very interesting because a funny thing happened. Well, it wasn't laugh out loud funny. A strange thing happened during the BP spill in the Gulf. There was an unprecedented combination of satellite imaging systems that were all targeted on that one area in the Gulf. I mean, we had multiple imaging systems, visible infrared radar, collecting all the imagery they could get for weeks, of this area. It's probably the most saturated imaging collection of any place on the planet, that certainly that I know about.
Right.
And so there was this abundance of image data. And the strange thing that happened was, on multiple images, we noticed small oil slick day in and day out that appeared to be coming from a known oil platform location just 12 miles off the coast of the Mississippi Delta, and about 30 miles away from the location of BP's leaking well. It had nothing to do with the BP spill. But again and again on these images, we saw an oil slick at that site. And so South Wings actually got up in the air and flew to the coordinates that we provided based on our satellite images. And on board, they had a member of the Waterkeeper Alliance, John Wasson, who's the Hurricane Creek Keeper. And they also had a professional photographer from New York City, of all places, J. Henry Fair. And what they documented was another drill rig working at that location with a miles-long oil slick in the water next to it.
And
we didn't know. We're like, hey, what's going on here? First of all, this, according to government data, there's supposed to be a big permanent manned oil platform at this location. Now, an oil platform is a structure that doesn't move around.
Right.
It sits there. Yet what we saw was a floating drill rig that was just like the Deepwater Horizon rig that had just had the disaster a few weeks earlier, and an oil slick next to it. And we went, what is going on here? And the media picked it up, and people went crazy thinking that there was another drill rig that was having a big problem. And then the story emerged that, no, that drill rig is actually on the site of where there used to be a platform. There used to be an oil platform there, and it had 28 wells, oil wells, in the seafloor underneath it. And it was destroyed by Hurricane Ivan in 2004.
Some of those
wells have been leaking ever since. That's now 7 years on that we've had this chronic day-in, day-out leak from this point just 12 miles off the Louisiana coast. And nobody knew about it. Of course, the Coast Guard knew about it. And then Minerals Management Service knew about it. And the responsible company said, look, we've been working with these government agencies. Don't worry, it's not a big deal. But I think the point that was interesting was, we, the public, didn't know this was going on. And it was quite a surprise and shock that we could have oil wells leaking right off the coast for going on 7 years, and they still hadn't fixed it. So Waterkeeper was part of the key to uncovering that story. And so we thought, well, we want them as part of the alliance. They really care about this, for one thing. For another thing, they have volunteers, people with boats, people with water experience throughout the country, and especially in the Gulf region. And we know that if we see something on satellite imagery and South Wings confirms it from the air, we can call up the Waterkeeper and get somebody on a boat out there
to collect
samples or photos or video or at least firsthand observation of what's actually happening. And so together we make this, I call it our SWAT team, our space, water, air, investigative team to document what's going on with pollution beyond the catastrophic spills that get all the attention.
Wow. And I will tell you this. I want to get to a couple of things. We're going to have to take a short break. But I think that it's so amazing to me, the other pieces of it. And it, just quickly, doesn't any of the oil end up on some of those beautiful beaches in the Gulf? I mean, does it all just dissipate into the ocean? Or why do people not on the shore, the public that goes to, you know, go to the Gulf of Mexico for vacations, with it going on that long, didn't it show up on the beach?
Well, I think we're still trying to answer that question. And, you know, some of the flights that Southwings is doing are in response to, you know, reports we're getting from citizens who live in the area, from fishermen who are spotting these mystery oil slicks out of the water.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break. Our guests, our featured guests, Gulf Monitoring Consortium, John Amos, president of SkyTruth, Jim Grody, conservation director of Southwings. We'll be right back talking more about some
University
of the economic...
University of Arizona professor John Pollard asked the students in the Posada San Pedro Hall to consider bringing solar energy to the dorm. Just 3 years later, the Solar Cats, a group of students who took up the cause, have installed 44 solar panels on the dorm, saving 20,000 kilowatt hours of energy and reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 14 metric tons every year. Talk about students with a sunny future. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Hi, I'm Abbott Taylor. With over 35 years creating jewelry in Tucson, no one has more experience in designing and making diamond jewelry in Tucson than Abbott Taylor Jewelers. Please come in and see some of the thousands of designs we have created, or come in and have us design something original just for you. Whether you're looking for a simple and stylish graduation gift, your engagement ring, or a breathtaking jewelry piece to celebrate an important birthday or anniversary, you can't beat our competitive diamond pricing. With 100% trade-up guaranteed, set in an Abbott Taylor jewelry design, always using earth-friendly recycled gold. Abbott Taylor Jewelers, exquisite jewelry designs and exceptional diamond deals created right here in Tucson for over 35 years. Abbott Taylor Jewelers at 6383 East Grant Road, on Facebook and on the web at atdiamonds.com. Diamond designs for everyone. Abbott Taylor Jewelers.
The Fairfax Companies is Tucson's green waste disposal solution. Contractors, landscapers, or do-it-yourselfers, come see us. We recycle almost all types of construction and landscape waste. Eastside Speedway and Prudence, Northwest I-10, Southeast Drexel and Houghton. The Fairfax Companies is the leader in the business of sustainability. We're open to the public and cost less than other landfills. Call 290-9313, 290-9313, or visit us online at thefairfaxcompanies.com.
Hi, this is Mrs. Green. Do you know that you can save up to $258 a year on fuel costs when you drive a VW 2011 Jetta TDI clean diesel from Chapman? And you can travel up to 609 miles per tank and reduce those ugly, sooty emissions by 90%. And remember, Chapman doesn't just sell cars. They provide you with the best ownership experience possible. Visit them at 4600 East 22nd Street between Columbus and Swan and tell them Mrs. Green sent you.
You can always find things around the house to give to Goodwill. But I have a bigger reason to give. My brother, Jim. When Jim was just 6 weeks old, he had a stroke. He had to rewire his brain to do most things we all take for granted. Thanks to Goodwill, Jim has a job and a sense of purpose. You know how they say your donation to Goodwill changes lives? Well, it's true. Goodwill is the best thing that ever happened to Jim. Please donate today.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. Thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. Please don't forget to follow me on Facebook and Twitter or subscribe to my newsletter, because it is a great way to connect the big green dots, and we keep making them bigger and bigger, bigger and bigger. Today, we have two incredibly intelligent, informed, experienced guests from the Gulf Monitoring Consortium, Jim Amos, president of SkyTruth, and Jim Grody. John Amos, I don't know if I said Jim. I'm so overwhelmed by some of the content you've given us. Jim Grody, conservation director for Southwings. And we have been talking about the BP oil spill, the disaster that it was and continues to be, the underreporting. And during the quick break, I can't help but ask each of you, are there not some type of federal oversight or reporting requirements that mandate that if there is a spill, you know, you said the Coast Guard knew and then, you know, more people knew, but if there was a leak from 2004, is there not anything in place with all the government regulations that we do have
some of which I truly value, that isn't there some type of reporting requirement? So this could have been caught a little bit before 2000, even 2010?
Well, there is, and this kind of goes back to something that John was talking about before the break. The industry is actually pretty good about when it looks like one of their spills or their mistakes is going to hit land and they're going to get caught. They're pretty good about trying to clean it up and putting out booms to protect shorelines. They don't always work, but they're pretty good about making that show. It's where they don't think they're going to get caught, where the oil is unlikely to reach the shore or unlikely to be seen by fishermen. That's where they don't do the reporting and they don't do the cleaning up that they are supposed to do. So yes, there is a reporting requirement, and there is a Coast Guard National Response Center, and there's a law that says that anybody who spills oil has to report it to this National Response Center. But if they don't think they're going to get caught, they probably won't do it.
So if nobody's watching, and if it, I know, and
right.
We got kind of cut off for the response to it showing up on the pristine beaches. I know that you're both involved in the scientific collection of important data to report, but just from being people that live in the area, do you see, have you assessed ongoing, economic disasters and things that I cared about very dearly, about people that made their livelihood forever as fishermen, and the implications for that? And I also wanted to ask about the contaminated fish. I mean, if there are oil spills that are leaking to this extent, what kind of shrimp are people eating here in Tucson, Arizona, that come from the Gulf of Mexico? It's like, makes me a little bit nervous.
That is a serious concern.
It is, really.
The fishing season last year was greatly diminished. The harvests were greatly diminished compared to previous years. There are a lot of fishermen out there who don't know if they're going to be able to make it. They are the early signs from this year's fisheries, from what I understand, are disheartening. They are the numbers don't look like the numbers of new spawn and new animals look like they are going to be lower than in a normal year. So there is reason to fear the quantity. In terms of the quality, testing has shown that there have been impacts on many of the species that have been caught. I can't claim to be an expert on the details of exactly what PAHs and metals have been found in what species, but I know that there are significantly elevated levels of a number of different compounds and heavy metals that have been seen in tested fish and shellfish from the region since the spill. So there is clearly a correlation between the ongoing oil industry and contamination of the fisheries.
Yeah, the food supply and then the economic implications. Exactly. And it was devastating to watch some of the people that were on national TV about their livelihood. And it's like farmers. I mean, you're a lot of the, I would say, not the big farm companies, but local fisheries, they're making it season by season. They're not socking it away for their big profits every year. So something like this, it's a year by year process, and I can't imagine the implications, economically. And then, of course, there's our food supply, which is about six other shows that I like to do. What about when you... go ahead.
I just wanted to comment on the economic significance of this, because I think this is a really important issue. Before the break, we were talking about the beaches of the Gulf, and wasn't oil coming up. And the, you know, the fact is the Gulf is historically a pretty oily place. And so some of the beaches of the Gulf have long had tar balls regularly on the beach from either from oil production activity or from the hundreds of natural oil seeps that exist in the Gulf. People have worked as fishermen and as drill hands. You know, the industries have been side by side for a couple generations in the Gulf, and I think, you know, I think in places people just get very accustomed to a certain level of pollution that comes along with that. They've learned to live with it.
Sad but true. I agree.
And I think, and also the Gulf is somewhat unique in that it's got this thriving bacterial ecosystem that actually helps biodegrade oil I think where this becomes important is when you talk about the other places around the U.S. and around the world, really, where new offshore oil drilling is being considered. These may be places that don't have a history of that. They may be places like Florida, like Virginia, like North Carolina, that have strong economies that are based on clean beaches.
What about the Jersey Shore? I'm a Jersey girl. I mean, I was used to clean beaches all my life. Can it impact the Jersey Shore?
Well, you know, there are some occasional slicks submitted off the Jersey Shore that are probably attributable to spray-on tanning products. But other than that, it's a pretty good point.
I'm telling you, it was never me. Never used them once. Okay.
But for these places, you know, I think these places need to pay closer attention to, you know, what is the day-to-day pollution associated with offshore drilling? You know, we're being bombarded with hundreds of millions of dollars of advertising messages every year that the industry spends to tell us that high-tech modern drilling is squeaky clean and there's nothing to worry about. And they've really amped it up now after the BP spill. And so I think people really need a better understanding of what, if they accept offshore drilling off their coasts, what the implications could be for those other economies that they've come to rely on, for the tourism economy, for the seafood and fishing economies that rely not only on a really clean beach and water, but also the perception that it's clean. That's just as important.
And John and Jim, both of you, I think that one of the things that just I am so passionate about is never underestimate the power of the people. I say that in the one hand, and I say I hate it when people say that, you know, green is more expensive or come up with all of these mantras why we can't do things right. The daunting thing to me in this is that I do believe there are incredible economic implications for businesses that may come late to the party and not realize that, oh yeah, I like offshore drilling as long as we're not getting foreign oil. But when the boardwalk closes in Asbury Park or Atlantic City, not so much. That being said, there are times, and my granddaughter is the one that brought it home to me in a very poignant way this past Christmas, about what can we do, the size and the power and the money behind big oil companies. It's daunting even to me. And, you know, I want to be the Oprah of green, so not much daunts me. But what can, is it going to take more collectives like yours, more consortiums of people not waiting for the disaster to strike and start the cleanup, but being proactive with partnering with an incredible group like yours to raise people's awareness, to keep it in the press. I think people really do want to know, and we've got to keep it in front of them because it's, you know, it's so yesterday if it isn't in the news today. It's not trending on Google, trust me. So what is your kind of call to action, and what do you think people can do? And, you know, there's a lot of questions in there. Are other organizations reaching out to you already and being proactive about what incredible research that you have in terms of the implications? So that was like six questions, but I told you I was a whirling dervish.
Do you want to take a crack at that?
Sure.
Yeah. What can we do? That's a good place to start.
What can we do? There are so many things we can do. We're just three of the organizations working on these Gulf-related issues. There are a host of other groups down there. If you are interested in the Gulf and you want to help preserve the Gulf, support those organizations, support our organizations, support the people who are trying to hold the oil industry accountable. And there are some things you can do legislatively. There is a bill pending in the U.S. Congress right now called the Restore Act.
Okay.
Don't ask me what the Restore Act stands for. It's one of those acronyms that I couldn't begin to tell you what it means, but the goal of it is to make sure that the fines that come out of the BP disaster go back to the Gulf area to help restore the Gulf and to prop up and revitalize those economies that have been destroyed by the impacts of this spill and the ecosystems that have been impacted by this disaster. So tell your Congress people, tell your senators that you want to see this money go back to the Gulf and ask them to support the Restore Act. Tell your Congress people that there are restoration things that can be done, restoration projects that can be done in the Gulf area that can help minimize and counteract the effects of the spill and the ongoing activities of the oil industry. What a lot of people don't know is that just as bad as the impacts of the oil itself are the impacts of the infrastructure that is used to get that oil. There are, if you ever look at a Google Earth picture of the Gulf, you see all these straight lines cutting through the marsh. These are the pipelines and the shipping canals that go through the marsh so that the oil industry can get its product back and forth from the Gulf. And Louisiana is losing on the average of a football field an hour of marsh. It's just an incredible story of land loss that doesn't get the recognition and the media play that the big disaster, the single disaster did, but that is having just as devastating effects. So let people know that you want to see that stop. You want to see marshes being restored rather than destroyed.
And it's shocking to me, having been involved in advocacy issues for 36 years in my public and you know, my corporate life, how if 50 people in Arizona, in Tucson, or in Phoenix, or people that are listening, I have people listening from all over the country, decided to get into action. If you get 10 calls at a congressional office, the staffers pay attention. I mean, we're not talking about 100,000 people here, so we can get people's attention by being an active constituency. It always surprised me how people that I have, friends that are in politics, say it really doesn't take much. If you want to get my attention, if we get 10 letters, we know there's something here, because there's a larger number of people not doing it. So I will definitely follow up on that and put something up on my Facebook and hopefully write a blog about it. What about, we're going to have to take another break, and the breaks always annoy me because it's always like I have the next great question that I want to answer. But when the companies do report, when they feel compelled because they know they're going to get outed, and here I always do it in the break, but we'll come back to it. Did they tell the truth? Is there accuracy in reporting? Do you guys have any, inside scoop, or what have you found in terms of that? Because it's probably not, you know, I make up stories in my own head about probably not. I mean, they're going to report the minimum.
It's a great question, and I would love to take a crack at that one.
Okay, so we should do this because we only have 1 minute. We'll come back to that, and I think it's the other things that I want you to think about. We're on break, which I'd like to close the show with. What can we do for fueling our cars? You know, oil is a disaster almost everywhere. So we'll be right back. Thanks for staying here with me. Stay tuned.
Go deep underwater without getting wet. Study bugs like a real scientist. Make your shadow move in colors. These are just three reasons to visit the exciting hands-on new exhibits at the Children's Museum Tucson, the region's only museum just for kids. For 25 years, we've ignited kids' imaginations at the Children's Museum Tucson. That's something to celebrate. And admission is only $2 on the first Sunday and on the 25th of each month this whole year. Children's Museum Tucson, where imagination and learning connect.
Hi, this is Mrs. Green. Do you know that you can save up to $258 a year on fuel costs when you drive a VW 2011 Jetta TDI clean diesel from Chapman? And you can travel up to 609 miles per tank and reduce those ugly, sooty emissions by 90%. And remember, Chapman doesn't just sell cars. They provide you with the best ownership experience possible. Visit them at 4600 East 22nd Street between Columbus and Swan and tell them Mrs. Green sent you.
At the University of Arizona, we're putting solar know-how to work. And it's not just our researchers. Our students are on the job as well. Our student solar racing team, using recycled solar cells from NASA, designed and built a car from scratch that gets the equivalent of over 3,000 miles per gallon. Talk about students who will go far. Really, really far. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And we are glad that you are listening. Thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. Don't forget to check me out on Facebook and Twitter. I always forget to put that in there because I'm so happy when this boy is back in town. We have Scott Catta with us again. Always a pleasure, Scott. He is from Legendary World, and he is going to share some great green tidbit with us again.
Hey, Mrs. Green. All right. One of the things I want to talk about is we have a great hotel program through Legendary World. I know you've used it. Many of your friends have used it. We have about 800 hotels around the world that are part of our signature hotel program. And we have special amenities. Lots of times it'll be a complimentary breakfast. The Biltmore up in Phoenix.
Lots of
our clients here use it. It can be $99 a night.
Yes.
And you get a $100 credit in their restaurant.
For the most fabulous
amazing
food.
Deals. We have Dove Mountain here in Tucson, the new Ritz-Carlton
have
up in Marana.
Have not used that one.
I haven't been there myself. But my favorite, which fits in with our whole talk about sustainability and green, is Miravelle.
Right up the street.
I mean, it's amazing. Of course, everybody knows Oprah's favorite spot. One of your favorite spots.
Mrs. Green's favorite spot.
But again, their commitment to sustainability, I mean, it's bigger than just recycling. I mean, it's a health and wellness. It's teaching.
The whole green enchilada.
You spend more time up there than I do, so you could probably even give a better example.
Well, it's life in balance. And to me, it's one of those things where they are subtly but very clearly proud of their branding as a sustainable resort. They have signs around the property that are very subtle and beautiful that say things like, you know, currently Miraval hauls away approximately 3 tons of glass, number 1 and 2 plastic paper products,
wow,
aluminum and tin cans, and then they say 1.5 tons of cardboard material bimonthly, and they educate their employees and train them so the amount increases daily. It's not great if it's a mandate from management. That's not how they do things. It's very, very authentic.
Bottom up.
I love that you brought up Miravel, and I didn't even know you were going to do that.
And it is in our hotel program. So again, clients can call us or reach us through our website at legendaryworld.com. There's a hotel search section, and it has information about Miraval as well as the other hotels we have around the world, and they can book right through us. We've got some amazing deals. And even at Miraval, we have some special value-added amenities that you don't get when you book directly with the resort.
Which, oh, by the way, I did not know and will be talking to you about, and I'm not kidding, I'm planning a day spa there for my birthday with my friend Cindy Windy, because we would like to actually be part-time residents of Miraval. But they built
part-time.
A whole new bunch of, that's right, you know, a couple weeks a month. They built some really beautiful new rooms that you can stay in. They're upgrades, and they are totally green. They're LEED certified, and they are absolutely beautiful. Every single thing. They have an outside shower and an inside shower, and it's rock. I mean, the building is made from all of the materials collected right in the area. It's a wonderful place to be, and it is about life and balance.
Yeah, it's one of our favorite spots here in Tucson.
So I can't wait for us to, like, maybe have a trip out there. A Mrs. Green retreat for clients. Okay. Scott from Legendary World, we're always so happy to have you with us, and this sure was fun sharing about Miraval. And it's always interesting to me when we have Scott on the show how the topic today is to me one that really does, it brings me a very heavy heart. I think that having the blessing of John Amos, who's president of SkyTruth, and Jim Grody, who's conservation director of South Wings, is so important. And that's why I need Miraval, because I go out there and I escape it all and think, you know, this is my oyster for a while. So guys, thank you for being with us. When we went to the break, John, you were ready to field the question, I believe, about accuracy in reporting when these spills occur. What have you found, and how do you find out?
Well, our main data source for oil and hazardous material spills in the U.S., as Jim mentioned, is the National Response Center.
Right.
And I just want to point out that anyone, it's not just the people who cause the pollution, but any citizen who observes or thinks they observed an oil or hazardous material spill to the land, to the air, or to the water is encouraged to report that to the NRC. So you can, there's a 1-800 number, you can call the National Response Center and file a report with them. And so that's our main source for information about spills in U.S. waters. And I just want to give you, throw some numbers at you. An example, we looked at the NRC reports collected for a calendar year from October 2010 to September 2011. And there were 2,900 reported oil or refined petroleum spills in the Gulf region for that calendar year. This is
in that region alone?
In the Gulf, yeah.
Okay.
And, 5% of those reports.
Okay, John, you're going out there a little bit. I don't know if it's your phone or what happened. Can you hear me now? Jim, are you still there?
I'm still here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, and I don't know what happened with John's...
Okay, yeah. Well, I fortunately know what John was talking about there, and I can hopefully try to... He would probably do a better job than I will at saying what he was getting at, but I will do my best. So, as John said, there were about 2,900... reports of spills. Of those, about about two-thirds of them either estimate a volume that is spilled or estimate a size of a sheen or an oil slick associated with that spill, or both. And so about a third or so have no estimate whatsoever. And so for those, we have no real ability to figure out, you know, what are they, how much did they really discharge. But we can get some ideas from the others, because we know that there's a minimum sheen size that can come from a given volume of oil. There's a minimum thickness, and if you multiply that out and divide it out, you can come up with sort of a minimum volume for that area. And what we found was that in the reports where they gave us both a volume and a sheen size, the average volume was actually significantly smaller than the minimum volume that could be produced, that could produce a sheen of the size known. So we looked at 102 relatively large spills that reported a slick that exceeded 100 acres.
Okay.
And the reason for that was because the small ones, you know, the numbers are just so small, a tiny mistake makes a huge difference.
Right, right.
So we kind of threw those out. But what we came up with on that was of those 102 reports, the average reported amount was 54 gallons, but the using our method for the minimum amount, it was an average of 1,985 gallons, so 36 times. Just a phenomenal apparent misreporting or underreporting.
A little discrepancy there. Isn't that just a nice way to sugarcoat it on my part?
Am I back? Are you?
John,
you are
back. Oh, that's
Yay.
Great. I was going to be so sad because our technology is working.
Jim's doing a great job, but I just wanted to say that, so based on what we actually observe, we conclude that underreporting is fairly common, if not systematic. But I have a little bit of good news, if that's what you want to call it. It's not good news that we had a major oil spill off the coast of Nigeria that you may have heard of from a Shell offshore facility. And Shell initially reported that the spill was, using very strange language, they said the spill was less than 40,000 barrels.
Okay.
In other words, somewhere between 0 gallons and 1.7 million gallons. That was how they described it. And when we saw satellite imagery of that oil slick and did our calculation for how big we thought it was, we actually came close to the high end of their estimate. In other words, it looks like they provided an estimate that more or less matched up with what we actually observed. And so we think that oil companies are getting the message that as long as SkyTruth and Southwings and Waterkeeper Alliance are on the job, as long as we're monitoring things, not just at home, but around the world when they happen, you can spill, but you can't hide.
I love it. Oh, my gosh. I'm going to use that. And I have to say, you guys are being passionate and informative and nice, but it's really, instead of underreporting, I would call it like egregious fabrication. And I'm not the scientists that are taking the information, but as a mainstream person, I'd say, oh, they lied. So it's not shocking and appalling to me. I don't live in a bubble, but it is pretty egregious to me that it could be that underreported. And I get it. I mean, there's a piece of the puzzle that just came to me. You guys help hold it accountable. There's such transparency because of all of our social media and multimedia sources that it probably makes them very nervous that you're out there watching, and that is such a good thing for our planet. And this is my really tough question, and we have about, 8 minutes left or 7 minutes left. One of the challenges in my world, and I talk to people in every area of sustainability that you can imagine, from solar to fashion, genetically modified food is another passion of mine. Clean water is one of my biggest passions. It haunts me that 1.5 billion people go to bed every night without access to clean water. There's implications for that. But when it comes to energy, I wrote a blog called What the Frack, because I'm not a big fracking fan, okay? Everybody touts the commercials about natural gas. It's the answer. It's nirvana, folks, and it's not, because they don't talk about how it's extracted. And when you talk about putting in the pipeline that's coming from Canada, there's awful, to me, just awful implications for that and devastation of areas that will never be the same if we allow it. What is going to give me gas for my car? That's what people want to know. I have a very active social media interaction with people that are part of my world. What do you guys say? What can we do? Because we do want to drive our cars. It's the American way. I, of course, drive a fuel-efficient car now. I've got a friend who has a Hummer, and I love her dearly. But it's like, really? It's like, who needs a Hummer? So what is your answer what are we going to do?
I think you've started to answer the question right there. I mean, we know what the easy answers are. There are easy answers and hard answers, in that some are obvious and some are less obvious. But I think, you know, there's a lot we can do in terms of efficiency in this country. And you see it when gasoline prices go up, people get smarter about the driving they do. They drive less. When gasoline prices top $4 a gallon, people cut way back on their mileage, and they still manage to do just fine. They
right.
still manage to get to work, get the groceries, but people were more thoughtful about how they spent their dollars in terms of filling up their tank. I think we can do a lot of better, more efficient use of the petroleum that we have, because I think we're going to be driving on petroleum for some time, but we could be doing it a lot smarter. And the other thing is we could do the drilling a lot smarter. And this is important. We're having a national conversation now as we go into an election year about what is the appropriate role for government in society. And I think an appropriate role is for government to provide vigorous oversight of the use of public resources, like our offshore mineral resources. And I think we need to spend the money that it takes to ensure that we have adequate government inspection and oversight of every phase of oil production offshore. There's just no substitute for that. So I think, you know, in terms of driving, drive smarter. And when it comes time to buy a new car, think about what you really need, and think about if you can buy something that's more efficient, that's easier on the planet, easier on your pocketbook. Those are some simple things people can do without really compromising their lifestyle.
I think it's important to say that you don't necessarily have to buy the most efficient car out there. There's a term that people use, right-sizing your car.
Right.
And we use that in a lot of contexts, but it's important in the context of your car, too. If you can get by with a small and very efficient car, you should buy that. If you're a farmer, a Prius isn't going to really work for you, and you should recognize that.
That's right. It is not going to work for you. But you don't need an F-150.
You may not need an F-150, exactly. So use the right size of car for you, and recognize that, you know, if you are a farmer and you're trying to use a Prius, you're probably going to do a lot more damage than using the right kind of car. So don't try to make everything fit what it's not designed for.
And make an informed decision. I think that makes so much sense. I mean, and one of the things, like in my world, we are very conscious of carpooling. Like if there's, you know, four couples that are going to go out to dinner and we're going to, you know, drive downtown, we figure it out now. And it's just, it's the better thing to do for the planet, but it's also more cost efficient. It helps with pollution and all of that. You know, you guys, it's just to me we didn't even touch on the shape that the oceans are in, and we have a minute left. So very quickly, can you just give your website so that people will know how to get in touch with you? And I want to just say a warm, heartfelt thanks for being on the show, and all of our technical difficulties got conquered. So what are your websites, and how do people get in touch with you? John?
Sure.
We're pretty simple. It's skytruth.org. SKYTRUTH.org.
Okay. And Jim?
We're also pretty simple. Southwings, SOUTHWINGS.org. And I should also say that the Waterkeeper Alliance, our partner, is waterkeeper.org.
And that's what's great is there's always information, Gina at Mrs. Green's World, info at Mrs. Green's World. We do get inquiries from our listeners. You guys, you know, I just bless you for the work you're doing, and I will stay in touch. Thanks for being on Mrs. Green's World Radio Network.
Thanks
and to my listeners, thank you.
Make it a great green week.